doing this morning, or
a little practice we did at lunch, or great insights you had in your nap?
I found those practices very helpful, both of them.
Okay, good.
The short version.
Anyone else?
I felt that for me, the time, it was a time practice, that one where we were, at least in part, I mean, I suppose they're all time practices, but time did really stop.
Good.
Just pause. It was just going to pause the whole time, and then all of a sudden, like,
which time practice?
Let's see, which one? The one where we were, he didn't call it a time practice.
I know, that's why I was wondering.
The one where we were paying attention to the activity of experiencing while experiencing a sensation and noticing.
Mm-hmm. The experience and the experiencer. Or if you could.
Right. When you get outside.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't necessarily think of that as a time practice, but it has a, you know, all our experience, of course, has a time dimension to it. And it's natural to focus on time when you're working with the self, because the self's identity is a temporal identity. You know, the reason, one of the reasons we think of ourselves as being selves is that we can look back, you know, and look forward. And there is a stream of memories that is ours and not anybody else's. And we have our plans.
What about our conflicts? That's if it's time bound, then,
mm-hmm.
you know, the self. I think that's very interesting. Conflict is because it's caught in time.
Yeah, you mean like there's sort of a conflicted self,
mm-hmm.
and that conflict comes from being caught in time? Yeah, I think that's true, because in any given moment, there's not really a conflict, right?
Right.
Conflicts have to do with what needs to be done, or
past and present.
Past and present, yeah. Right.
I still find it really curious that no matter how good you feel when doing these things, and how new and how relieving of tension, or of really just of the self and therefore tension, that they're so hard to remember to do.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems. Is the self just doesn't care how you feel, how it feels, you
mm-hmm.
feel.
Yeah. Well, there's a story you could tell about that, which is sometimes brought up in the TSK books, and that is that the self is self-protective, you know, and these kinds of experiences are somewhat threatening, and so the self reacts against them. I don't know if you need to go that far, though. I mean, that may be true. But it's just that the self always does what it does, you know, and it's very difficult if you say we're going to put two things in balance. So here's my very interesting and illuminating and joyful experience here, and here's, you know, the weight of everything I've been doing for 30 or 40 or 50 years or whatever it is. Well, this one really, you know, tends to outweigh this one, and it just, things automatically go back in this direction. It's just there's this tremendous inertia or momentum. And that's actually one reason, you know, one of the issues that's always interesting to me in TSK, because the question comes up for people quite a bit, you know, how's it related to Buddhism, how's it related to meditation, how's it related to Kunye, how's it, you know, what about just the quality of, you know, being able to relax and to experience, isn't that really valuable? And yes, it is. But the thing about TSK is that it's trying to, it suggests a way of working with our experience that is that accepts the experience for what it is. Not more than what it is. You know, it doesn't accept all the claims that get trumpeted, perhaps, but it accepts the experience for what it is. So it's not as though you have to say to yourself, usually my experience has these qualities, and then sometimes I have a different kind of experience, and I would like to be able to have more of these different kinds of experience. You know? That's a model that we tend to work with a lot in different meditative practices, spiritual practices. The TSK very much says, right within our ordinary experience, you can be approaching it differently. So it goes back to this question of asking, well, then why do you have to train in TSK? Well, because it's very well established. We have well-worn ways, well-traveled paths, and there's a lot of momentum. That is a good word. Rinpoche talks about momentum in different places, and at one point I remember he uses, I think it's a lot of knowledge, he uses the image of trying to stop a, he uses two different images, I'm confusing them a little bit. The one I'm thinking of right now is, I think it's like trying to stop a plane that's traveling along at, whatever they travel at these days, 700 miles an hour. And that in itself is hard enough, but if I remember correctly, the image he uses is you're trying to stop it while you're a passenger inside.
Do you think, going along with what Cecilia said, that if you're, I'm bringing in a psychological term, but if your ego or self is very well defended, is it more difficult then? I mean, so that you don't even identify that you have conflicts, and so when you said that self may be threatened and retreat, so someone who has more malleability around saying, oh, I'm wrong, or sorry, see that, could have an easier time remembering or fostering that.
Yeah, I think so. I think if you say that the self is very well defended, it seems to me what you're saying is that it's got a story that it doesn't want to call into question.
That's
right.
And
that commitment to the way things are makes it very difficult to raise any issues. There's no openness, no possibility. And it's at that point, I think, you can start talking about certain strategies that the self uses. You can the strategy of feeling confused or feeling irritated, or there's various kinds of emotional reactions which may signal, they may be involved with something entirely different, but they may signal a kind of a very momentary opening. And then to seal that opening, you bring in the big guns, which are the emotions, right?
To seal that opening open.
To seal it closed. I always have the image of a self-sealing tire. You puncture the you get a flat, there's a puncture, and it exudes some, I don't know how they work exactly, some sticky stuff, right? That seals the tire closed. So that's what I mean when I say seal.
Well, I mean, of course, I had that, maybe I'm missing that point. I had the feeling or thought that if there's irritation or moodiness or 20 factors of instability, approximately, that it's an opportunity to look at that. And so rather than close it over, you could open it, not believe it, but say, okay, that's a reflection of, and can we look at that,
That's right. That's what the speaker is saying.
Yes, I'm fascinated by that. You've been doing it all afternoon.
Right.
A professor who's done that for years. Isn't there a professor? Krishnamurti.
Well, Krishnamurti did that. He would.
But no, there is a professor who refuses in the middle. Is he in Chicago? Who has for years not used the word I?
Well, when, Susan said that she wouldn't like that. We should say the woman says.
Mm-hmm. Instead of saying the speaker says.
Yeah. I don't know. It sounds too identified.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, you were saying.
I was saying that you know, you're just you're pointing to a different stage in the process. I mean, first, let's imagine there's a kind of an opening, and then there's a defensive reaction to that, and it shows up as an emotional reaction.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're not committed to the story, let's say, then you don't have to be committed to the emotional reaction either.
Mm-hmm.
And so you say, oh, this is an interesting reaction. It suggests there's something to look at. Right? But if you are committed to the story, then the emotion is meant to reinforce that commitment. Or that's the way it's supposed to function. You know, that's the way our mechanisms are set up. And they say, oh, this is stupid, or
yeah,
this is boring.
I don't believe that.
Yeah, I don't believe that. Or I'm very confused. So there are a lot of emotional reactions on that level, which you could understand as signaling knowledge. Mm-hmm. That's what Arusha writes about that a lot in these books. He says confusion can be a positive indication that something of value is going on.
But you're saying so that would be the first thing, and then as we move along, then that's opening. Then there's opening, not sealing off that. Not that reaction you
don't want
that reaction,
mm-hmm.
but you're just saying, oh, well, when I do that, or when the speaker does that, or whatever.
Yeah, and it can be very tricky. I think the more you get into it, you know, the other day I had this experience, it was actually very strong. We were kind of, you know, for a long time when I was starting to study Buddhist stuff and then TSK came along, and I thought of myself as not having a lot of emotions. And gradually I began to realize that that wasn't true. But as I become more open, maybe, you know, as these teachings take more hold, you could say, sometimes I notice that because the emotions get really strong. I know I'm saying something that, you know, a number of you probably just have known almost intuitively for years, but because my starting point was, oh, Jack doesn't have emotions, right? Jack is almost like kind of on an even keel.
You do seem to be on an even keel.
Well, it came up the other day, and I was actually, I don't want to go into all the details, but I'm teaching a class. And during this class, something happened that made me, it wasn't an interaction in the class, it was kind of unrelated, but it made me think that something negative had happened. And I really became very obsessed with that, and there was no basis for it at all. Well, I'll tell you, the basic situation was just, when I teach, as those of you who know me from the Institute know, I'm always carrying my cell phone, and usually I remember to turn it off before I teach. Sometimes I don't, and it rings. I don't actually usually turn it off. I leave it on vibrant. And so so I know when I'm getting a phone call, even though I hope other people don't hear it vibrate. On this particular occasion, it vibrated, so I knew I'd gotten the phone call, and I just jumped to this assumption that it was a certain phone call that I realized then for the first time I was dreading getting. And I got very, very involved in the emotional response to that, even though I actually had no way even of knowing who had called me. You know, no idea at all. And it turned out not to be any phone call that
The
dreaded phone call never arrived, you know, it was okay. But I had a very strong reaction. And you know, when you have strong emotions, in my growing experience with this this dimension of experience, it is not easy to balance and be at the point of saying, in effect, you know, say, oh, this is a strong emotional reaction, you know, instead of just buying right into it. I was able to do that to some extent, but it was really, you know, doing that doesn't mean that the strong emotional reaction disappears. It's just that you're not completely identified with it. So.
I think that's one of the things for me personally that has made a big difference in TSD is I'm one big emotion. I think I made some progress actually in my reaction to my emotions because of this. And I have so many opportunities, as you know, with my mother. She is my practice. The thing that seems really that's made a difference for me is that seem to be more aware more immediately of my reaction and what's happening from whether it's usually a physical experience and then whatever follows that, but it's always emotion based and I'm not jumping to that reaction as quickly as I'm not reacting as quickly or sometimes in some cases not at all. But I also, and when we talked about this, you talked about it's inquiry. There's no solutions. There's no why am I doing this? You know, and that's what's been hard for me is to not really just delve into the story behind it. And getting kind of distracted by that rather than just being aware of. We really reacted to this, and it's not serving any purpose, or I'm judging that. But it's made a profound difference for me in that way. But I'm finding that I'm nowhere near where I feel like balanced or where I need to be because I seem to be hanging on to something else that's kind of heavy. Maybe it's my need to problem solve or to, I haven't quite let go of that part of it. But this is definitely, and I live in a situation that's more remote and I don't have a lot of interaction with a lot of people. And I find that when I do go out into the world, it's the reaction comes up pretty fast. You know, I mean, I don't have the same ability to kind of remove myself from the immediate situation and kind of look at it in a more objective view. I'm more reactive back out in the world. So it has to, little baby steps, I guess, going out. But
well, it's good to be aware of the reactivity. And as you say, you know, the story that comes along to justify the reaction is really, you know, it may make perfectly good sense or it may not, but it's not the place where the knowledge is available.
And then, you know, there have been a couple instances where I've had an experience of a voice or something inside of me that has some deeper understanding, and I think sometimes that's where my frustration comes from. I cannot tap into it. It eludes me. But the sense of it being there is so strong and so palpable. I have no doubt that it exists, and at some point, maybe I'll have the good fortune of therein lies why I'm here.
Well, one way to think about that would be to say if there's really an actual feeling of frustration, if that's not just the kind of a description that you apply afterwards, then the frustration really is the voice.
Okay. It feels like there's something that I can't hit. So that's the voice?
Yeah, well, that feeling, there's knowledge in that feeling, let me put it that way. But if you want to talk about it in terms of voices, fine.
There's a knowing. There's a knowing.
An opening.
It's like a portal that hasn't quite opened up yet.
Right, you know, and knowing that you're closed or knowing that you don't know, is very important. It's a perfectly valid expression of knowledge. We turn away from it because we say, no, I want to know. But it's
how come, and that's what I find, why can't we continually be comfortable in our not knowing? And not have to have everything figured out and, think that, and that's what I was thinking earlier too, you know, we may not be able to control things, but that doesn't mean that there's not a zillion things we can do about the situation.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So in a sense that gives some control, but it's very unsettling to be unsettled. And yet, that's where TSK kind of puts you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Or at least calls attention to that.
Do what?
Or at least calls attention.
Yeah. And it tries to encourage us to find comfort in that freedom, or we can label it freedom, but sometimes that freedom is unsettling.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't found the comfort part yet. I appreciate the increased awareness of how my mind goes
mm-hmm.
to different places, mm-hmm. but I don't necessarily find any comfort in that.
That's okay too.
I find the comfort because I can compare my relative response to, let's say, 5 years ago if this happened. You know, I would blow my lid off.
Yeah, okay, that's
and then, oh wow, I can just right now be sad about it and I'm not creating such a habit. That has a little comfort in it, but it's not like a very wonderful comfort.
there's not that, you know, lightness, and it's just, oh, geez, I'm still still operating in the same.
But Kathleen raised kind of an interesting point, because I think through the practice I've come to a similar place of I'm getting better at identifying these strong, you know, a strong reaction and pausing for a second and going, oh, that's a strong reaction. But you know, it's so easy to get sucked into that. Well, that's a strong reaction. I wonder why. And then you end
up, right.
Then you spend all day.
Right. You know, I guess my practical question would be, you know, so what's a good way of dealing that from a TSK perspective? You get to that, well, that's a strong reaction. Just sit with it and look at it? Or, I mean, what's, you know, what would be a good practice of that?
Yeah, I think really, you know, we did that practice this morning of working with the immediacy of experience with respect to the senses in the body, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's also the immediacy of the emotional, you know, the emotionality, the or the reactivity,
mm-hmm.
Or the discomfort. And actually, the approach we were taking is a way of working with that, of saying, you know, there is experiencing the reaction,
yeah.
And you know, our usual stance. Like if I see a dragonfly in front of me, you know, there's the experience of seeing the dragonfly. It's kind of at least easy to see the difference between the two, even though we don't usually focus on the interior aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm having an emotion, an emotional reaction, it's not so easy to see the difference between the two. But there is a difference.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's the emotion and there's the experiencing of.
So there's the emotion, and then there's what we think about it.
Well, it's partly the what we think about it. It may be that the emotion is already a kind of a reacting.
Mm-hmm.
You know? We have a feeling, and you know, the mind is very complex. So there may be a kind of an aversion. This is again kind of, I'm drawing on Buddhist ways of looking at it right now, but you know, there's a feeling of aversion or attraction, And then a grasping or rejection comes, and then that builds up into an emotion. You know, an emotion is kind of a complex that starts from that. So it may be that by the time you notice your emotional reaction, it is already a reaction. But that's what you have. I mean, you know, that's the immediacy of your experience, is that you feel like emotional. So
well, have you ever had a time where you felt like spontaneously overwhelmed with tears, and you don't, and then there's this sadness or there's this joy, and you really don't know where it's coming from, and there's nowhere to label it. Mm-hmm. It's still an emotion, but it's not, you haven't really given it a label. As to where it's come from, or why you're feeling it, or
right. I you know, I might not want to call that an emotion, but that gets into kind of a Buddhist labeling thing, and I don't think we need to go there.
Okay.
Well, I'd like to have us do some practice, because I've got a series of things here to do. So let's do them. They involve this past, present, future structure that supports stories, really. I mean, in a way, so this morning we did, we looked at this kind of sense of an ongoing story. This is going back in at a more basic level, you know. So the temporal structure that supports stories is as a past, present, future. And we all know all about that. I mean, you know, we're all very familiar. So we start, you know, the starting point is just our very ordinary experience. So let's start with a pen and paper in hand. Something to write with and on. And draw three columns. And one of them you can label past, and one of them you can label present, and one of them you can label future.
Does it matter what order?
It doesn't matter what order. There seems to, you know, that's how we usually say it. But, and therefore, think of it. But no, it doesn't matter. So now for the next few minutes, just let experience arise, any kind of experience, and see if you can notice, or you will notice for some experiences, whether they have to do with the past, or with the present, or with the future. So if you hear a sound, that's basically in the present. But if you think about what we had for lunch, that's the past. And if you're looking forward to going out into the redwoods, then that's the future. Like that. Very simple. Past, present, future. Okay? And just do a little tally. Okay, let's stop there. So add up your totals. How many of you are mostly in the present? Okay, almost everybody. Mostly in the past? Okay. Mostly in the future? Okay. That's about it for now. Anything else? Anything you noticed about that? Any times when you had difficulty classifying?
I put one or two in future just because they were a possible scenario. I wasn't projecting anything, but it was not a memory either.
Right, yeah. Right.
But how can even a memory or something you're thinking in the future not be in the present? And then how can it be in the present when by the time it's processed, it's already passed?
Mm-hmm. But we're looking at the content right now, and I think the point's well taken that you're having a memory that's a present experience. And if you perceived it that way, you know, if that's where your focus was, it was kind of in this two-way sensing, then that would be a present experience.
Okay. Right?
But if, in fact, you go into the content, then it's in the past.
What do you mean by going into the content?
Well, what I mean is if I imagine at one point I was imagining what I would say after this was over. So that was the content, right? I could have had that same thought and said, "Oh, I'm thinking about the future," and that would have been a present. That would have been a present experience. Usually, we go with, that's what I mean by context.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And usually, we go with that. Kind of a, okay.
The other thing I thought is maybe the environment had some kind of impact on, you know, because there's a lot of cues here for being in the present. You could hear sounds,
mm-hmm,
and
feel mm-hmm.
things, but you're laying in bed and it's completely silent. That's when I tend to think about the future.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, there did seem to be, but you know, in other circumstances, you might not have noticed it so much, but there did seem to be, you know, people were shifting in their seats,
yeah.
and there were the voices outside, and it partly depends on how fine-grained your analysis is,
mm-hmm.
you know. If you are listening to the voices outside, it may be that you say, okay, voices. You build up quite a bit of present that day.
Is hearing a thought?
Is hearing
a thought?
Well, you know, you think that's an easy question.
That's a good question.
You know, hearing is a sensing, but it has a thought component to it, usually, because we identify what we're hearing.
Exactly.
Right? We label what we're hearing. Those are voices outside. And you know, it's not typically such a fruitful thing, I don't think, to try to strip away the label and say, oh, it's a pure thought, or a pure
sense.
Yeah, sense. So I know it's fascinating by these examples. So just the other day, I heard one about some sort of a story on the radio about someone who got a cochlear implant. You know, this was someone
mm-hmm.
who had been deaf from birth.
Oh, yeah.
And so apparently for a long time the FDA, I'm not sure if they regulated, wasn't sure about putting cochlear implants in children, but they decided to in this case, or they gave permission. So this was a fairly young child at the age of 8 or 9, got a cochlear implant. And had an experience that apparently is fairly typical from the report I was listening, which was immediately there was something fascinating, like a whole new dimension of experience. But after that initial fascination, it was extremely difficult and proved more or less impossible to associate sounds with what they were of.
Yeah.
You know, the brain, the pathways in the brain hadn't developed. They were old enough, so they hadn't developed. And you know, they couldn't associate, I can't remember the details, but it was almost, they could only do a little better than guessing at identifying what the source of the sound was. The image that stays in my mind was, they were reporting on this one child, but they mentioned another one who, after they'd had this impact, this implant, had spent hours in the bathroom just flushing the toilet because it was so interesting to that, you know, that child to hear, to see how pressing that lever produced some result. You know? So that's kind of at the level of raw sound. Usually we don't need to or want to do that. Sometimes if we do a practice like Marriage of Sound and Breath, maybe, you know, we want to allow for the possibility of kind of a sound cut off from its label. That's a long answer to your question. Did anybody have the experience that something you noticed in one of the three temporal moments was really closely connected to another temporal mode? So, yeah. Okay. Well, that's where we're going to go right now. We're going to go to another exercise. The exercise here, the suggestion here, we've talked about related things, is that when you have an experience that is in the past or the present or the future, it has a link to the other two dimensions. So something is, let's say, mainly in the present, but there's a past, something, it evokes something about the past, or it evokes a possible future. Or if you have a future directed thought, there is a link to the present. Maybe it's that, you know, we notice that we're thinking in the present, but maybe not. Maybe it's that it's just linked to the present. You know, so like if I imagine going to the beach tomorrow, let's say, there is a kind of a subtle connection between that future imagining and our being here right now. I mean, there's a, you know, just in terms of causal connections, you could say, there's going to be a path that opens up between this moment and that moment. But I'm not saying you necessarily experience that causal connection, just that there is these other dimensions. It's kind of like, you know, like a triangle. So here's this point at the middle, which is in the past, present, or future, but it's got these two wings. So if this one is the future, two wings would be maybe the past and the present. So that all the different combinations are possible. That's the suggestion. Now, you may not find that, or you may not find it to be true all the time, but that is the suggestion. And so what we want to do is just take some time to explore that, to see if you can kind of become sensitive to those, that multi-dimensionality, that multiple temporality.
No, I'm just repeating that.
Okay. And if you find that it's not true, then we'll talk about that too. That's fine. But, okay. So we're going to take maybe 10 or 15 minutes to explore that. And then there'll be a little time to write. Thank you. minutes to write if you'd like. Okay. So I'm going to read you a little bit about what Rinpoche said about this exercise, which is exercise 19 in the TSK book. So here are the instructions for the exercise as he presents it. It's very short. Sit quietly, remain sensitive to all thoughts, feelings, and sensations. You may eventually be able to see a past and a future tinge to all your lived present moments. Each ordinary present has a subtle past, present, future structure to it that provides a feeling of personal identity, continuity, and direction. So he relates this to our self. Image or self-identity, right? That the past, present, future structure provides a feeling of personal identity, continuity, and direction. So then he has a little commentary. But I'm just going to stop there. So does that seem right to you, or what would you say based on your experience just now? Does that kind of fit with what he's saying? Mm-hmm. You want to say anything
mm-hmm.
about that?
Well, Yes, I feel that. But something is puzzling to me about how to utilize the meaning or something about the direction of the future. I'll give you an example briefly. I looked at you at one point, and you had an expression. You looked like you had your eyes closed and your head was tilted. And it immediately brought up an image of seeing my father asleep mm-hmm. as a child mm-hmm. and being scared by that mm-hmm. because I saw a non-active person. person, I suppose, or saw him in a relaxed manner. And so I noticed that with a start just now. And I can imagine my mind interpreting that in a myriad of ways. So how would you recommend that I maybe start to use that? I mean, because it feels laden with emotion and import to me,
right,
to the speaker.
Okay, so that kind of goes back to your question this morning.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think it's fine to explore that. You're asking me how to explore it.
Well, just as a like, you know, you made some suggestions of possibilities of
mm-hmm.
things.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can think of it, but I'm immediately going to one story that I
Right. So my suggestion, I guess, would be not to pursue that story out necessarily. And I think it's okay. But you know, you notice that, and as you say, there was kind of a start, and in that start, there was an emotion.
Okay, yes.
And I would say that's enough. You know, that's that moment of experience. And there's, I mean, the emotion is its own moment, and you know, maybe you go with it, but maybe something completely different comes up.
Well, all right. But the emotion, also the sudden awareness, there it doesn't feel like a story.
Mm-hmm.
Like the usual story that I
mm-hmm.
could create,
mm-hmm.
but it feels like maybe what Kathleen we were talking about with you, that sort of opportunity
mm-hmm.
to see, not sure what, but you know, what is actually going on or something.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that sense of opportunity is itself something to work with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's one of these things that I think is really fundamental in TSK, that we all have to have our own way of exploring. That the place, the part of our experience that's not content is so rich. And it may have the emotional dimension, but it may, you know, like what you just named, just a sense of opportunity. That's a place to go.
Right.
It's a little bit like what I guess Tina was asking you, Bruce, about this, or you mentioned that you had this language that you had made up that was all process oriented, right? But process is what we usually miss because we want to go into the way things are. And there's an image that I like very much that William James uses, where he talks about, he says, these are the image of a bird flying from branch to branch. And he says, all of our attention goes to the places where the bird alights.
But
what about, we never pay any attention to the flight from one place
mm-hmm.
to the next. And that quality of opportunity that you identified is like the
flight.
Right. And I think that's a really good place to look.
Okay. I'm puzzled that you keep using the word use that. I mean, I guess I don't understand what you mean by that. Use that.
You mean, how can I use the experience? I think it was related to what I said this morning about clues, that there seems to be in my mind a puzzle of, or an unfolding or a desire to do that, and I'm maybe looking for opportunities, might be another word, tools, ways to access it. It's as if I were mining something and I don't know how to get down to the gold or the ore or the whatever, and
All the go is there, you have to open up to it. Or at least that's been my experience.
Were you laughing because of the play on the word mining there?
I know.
Mining.
Yes, I know. Well.
But I think it's an interesting point you raised, Cecilia. Maybe that's an underlying story that mm-hmm. would be worth looking at
yes.
too. That you have this story. You know, I've got
yes,
to
actually
to
I wrote,
use.
I wrote that down this morning. That I have one of the stories of the five stories that I came up with have to do with I'm doing that. So.
Right. Okay, well, I'm going to have us do one more practice before the break, and there's kind of a sequence here which we may come back to because we're not going to finish it, but like this, I'm going to just let me read just a little more and then we'll do the next practice. So this is an example of exercises where Rinpoche says, you need to do this for a long time. He says, after extensive practice, so first it's the one that where we mark things off, past, present, future. That's not exactly how he says to do it. He says, just be aware how you're how much, of the time that you spend in the past, the present, and the future. And he says, do that a long time. Extensive practice. So we're not exactly doing it extensively. Even on a retreat, it's kind of like if we were doing a 6-month TSK retreat, which would be great. We did after Love of Knowledge was published, we did an intensive program at the Institute of Knowledge. We had two components. One was the evening component, where we had people come in 5 nights a week and worked our way through the book pretty systematically. But we also had a residential component. It was a small group, but we had 4 or 5 or 6, I don't remember anymore, people who did a 10-month Love of Knowledge retreat. And it was very powerful.
But it was.
Why did you stop it?
We did the evening component, I think, the next year also, and there wasn't as much interest. And then the third year, there weren't going to be enough people. I don't think we tried the residential part again. I can't remember why. Extensive practice of the exercise 18, and exercise 19 is this notion of every present moment having a past and future. And he says, with sufficient practice, the awareness of the structure of ordinary time that results from these will emerge as more than simply an attentiveness on the part of yourself. What he's suggesting is a deeper dimension to this. The way we normally approach this is kind of, well, I notice that there's a past and a future dimension to my present. He says it can be more than just that. Instead, it can be a knowing which is brought by time and keeps abreast of time, even where the self cannot do so. This knowing can see how the self is set up moment by moment and how its consolidating tendency, that's a term in the first book, narrows down the vastness of time. So we could stay with this exercise and really try to move in that direction, but we're not going to, because we're going to move on to the next exercise. I thought I'd at least give you that thought. So I'm going to read you this direction, because it's fairly you have to be kind of clear about what you're doing. As in the first exercise, look closely at your memories and past-oriented thoughts, as well as at your future-oriented plans and expectations. A characteristic feature of future-related images is that they are located up ahead of you. They are located up ahead of the present. you look from here to ahead of you, there. Similarly, the past is behind. You look back to it, even though it also has a quality of leading forward up to the present. So you look back toward the past and forward toward the future. That's what he's saying. So here's the practice. Starting with a specific thought or expectation regarding your future, so you can wait for one to come up or you could manufacture one. Okay? Reverse the directionality by which it is known in reference to your present. That is, look back from that future to the present. Do this repeatedly, and then make a similar reversal for the case of past memories and images. Look from the past to the present. And he does talk about doing this in a couple of stages, and the first one is the one that we'll just work with right now, which is, you know, he says, in effect, you visualize yourself, or you just kind of go back, let's say you're looking at the future, you'll forward to the future, and this is some little you that sort of time travels, right? You go forward to the future and you look back at the present from the future. And then the same thing with the past.
Wouldn't that be some sort of story making?
Yeah, I think there is a lot of story making in it. That's okay. I mean, we're using that. Especially with the future, with the past. Almost as much, but not quite as much. Okay, so that's the practice. We don't have a lot of time, so it'll take about 15 minutes to do this, okay? And let's take, what I'll do is start with the future, as you suggest. We'll really follow the directions from it. Start with the future, and at a certain point, I'll say, okay, now switch to the past. And just do it repeatedly is the idea. Okay, now I'll switch to the past. Okay, let's stop there. Just a little taste of that practice. I'll come back to it. So, anything you'd like to say? What about the difference, for instance, between the past and the future?
Well, I noticed immediately when I went from thinking about the future, I thought in positive terms, you know?
Uh-huh.
And then when I went to the past to come to the future, then I was thinking in negative, you know, bad things that had happened, mm-hmm. situation I wanted to hurry up and get out of. So that was funny to me.
Uh-huh. What did you, did you feel that there was a real connection among those, between those and the present moment?
Oh, yes. Yes, it, I can't get away from the connection of all of it.
Uh-huh.
I really can't. That's TSK's fault. Because I used to be really easy at, you know, whatever that word is, and separating things and dividing, and now not so much. And everything kind of blurs.
Okay. Bruce, you were going to say something.
Yeah, I noticed just different feeling qualities looking from different future events back. After a while, I found it easy just to keep popping a lot of different future events and looking back and noticed how my present experience almost became kind of flat. It became memory-like in reference to what seemed lively up there, and this came to be much more of a summary of the present, kind of became a summary present, essentialized or something.
Mm-hmm.
It just kind of changed the feeling of the present, mm-hmm. and the liveliness was up there.
Yeah.
But then there was a different feeling from looking from the past, and I was surprised by the past because I went way back, you know. I think probably snapshot scenes from 4 years old, and mm-hmm. you know, just the unlikelihood
right.
of these two things being juxtaposed together,
right?
You know, and that what emerged for me there was just the unlikelihood, and that connection between these two was what a rich, you know, I don't know how to describe it, but there seemed to be such a rich connection of events and currents, and just like a sense of, you know, however that got to here, kind of the unexpected abundance of time or something. I don't know how to put that, but there was something impressive about it.
Did you have that same sense of the liveliness of the past that you did with the liveliness of the future?
Yes, and in that case, the liveliness of the past was actually kind of like the liveliness of the present, but looking towards the future. But it actually felt richer because now I could kind of see mm-hmm. the enormity of kind of what had to unfold
mm-hmm.
to connect these two things. So it even felt like from the past towards the future, the liveliness was even stronger mm-hmm. than when I looked from here to that future, because that's kind of all a blur.
Right.
But now, from looking there to here, I felt, wow, you know.
Okay. So kind of like all that in-betweenness came alive, too. Is
yeah.
That, that's interesting. It's not, you know, if you found yourself having some difficulty with this, I mean, it's not so easy. I mean, sometimes it is, and it sounds like for you, and maybe for you, it's like, you know, you say, okay, you're kind of an access to aliveness, but we are pretty used to identifying the present as the place where the aliveness is. I guess that's the way to say it. That's a good way to say it. Anybody else? How about you, Ben?
I was finding it difficult. So, in fact, when I was trying to do the present looking back at the, sorry, the future looking back at the present, I was thinking, oh, maybe it would have been easier for me to start from the past looking forward. Just to have an example of how that might look.
Right.
So,
right.
But I didn't do that. So I just kept imagining a couple of things, and actually what happened was I got so involved in the content of the future,
mm-hmm.
I wasn't really spending much time looking back. I was like, oh, I kind of like this place. And so that's what happened in the future. And in the past, I found myself really just going back little, like not very far.
Uh-huh.
Like, so like, you know, just sort of going, oh yeah, 3 months ago, you know, before I started this, you know,
right.
6 month retreat,
right.
And
right.
sort of trying to look forward from there, and like even, you know, 3 weeks ago. I mean, like just sort of, and part of that was because a lot of stuff has happened
mm-hmm.
in that 3 months, so I was just sort of seeing if I could find some relation there. But even still, I never really felt like I connected to being in the past and looking forward.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's fine. But there was something there that was enlivening for you. So that's good. Did anybody do just like real short, like 5 minutes? Or
yeah, I did. That was like 1 or 2 minutes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that was really easy. And then I kind of expanded it out from there. I started with these short little intervals. I made it really easy to go.
Mm-hmm.
I stayed within the retreats from both sides.
Okay. There's a lot to be learned about that. One of the things that we're exploring here are that this gives us access to is that kind of story structure, right?
Yeah.
And how things play mm-hmm. themselves out in time, you could say. And, you know, the story, we kind of privilege. Well, we privilege the present, so we kind of privilege what's immediately around
mm-hmm.
the present, kind of warm, fuzzy glow of the immediate past and future. I'm going to give you a little assignment that's related to this that may be interesting and maybe not. For those of you who are going to go, I'm going to give you a future moment. And that future moment is tomorrow when we take the hike down to the beach. You cross the highway at the very end, you get to Highway 1, you cross the highway, and on the way down to the beach, there's a sign that shows the kinds of birds that live on that beach. So it's a painted sign with pictures of the birds that roost at that beach. So when you get to that future moment of getting to that sign, that's the future moment of looking back at this present moment.
Wow.
Okay. Okay. Let's see what that's like.
So when you're saying we see that sign, think back to this moment.
Yeah, and then let that, you know, maybe for that moment, maybe in that instant, let that be the present, the past of that future, and look back from that past, which is this present, to that future.
It sounds like Abbott and Costello.
Okay, so it's just when you get to that sign. When you're actually there, okay, and you get to that time, then do this exercise for a moment, and this is going to be the past moment
of that sign.
Of that moment of being at that sign.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yeah.
So Pamela, you come up with something else when you walk through the door into the classroom or something.
Yeah.
Whatever it is. Mm-hmm. Okay?
Cool.
Okay. Okay, so we'll take our break. It's 3:42, so 10 after.
Be at the Redwoods.
We'll be at the Redwoods. Remember to bring your a cushion, unless you want to sit. Well, bring the cushion. And I'll figure out about the yoga mats.
You don't need to take the books, though.
No, you don't need to take them. You don't need to take any.
No notebooks.
No books.
No notebooks?
No, I said notebooks. I thought you said notebooks.
No notebooks.
No notebooks.
No notebooks. You could bring your notebooks. That might not be a bad
idea. I'm just bringing my backpack.
Bring, yeah. and remember that it might be a little cool there, so bring a wrap.
Going to another climate.
Yes, notebooks. Huh?
Yes, notebooks. Yes, notebooks.
There are mats. I don't know exactly where they are. Tony was responsible. Not these mats. Don't bring these mats.
So we'll figure out how to get some mats.
The phone is ringing. Ryan's calling.
Somebody's calling from the future.
From the future. Signs no longer there.
Nobody there? Mm-hmm. That was the mat department.
I don't have my good serious jackets in the cabin. I don't want to go all the way back. We have such a short break.
It was so flat. I went back
12 years ago looking now, very, very kind of like silly, like, okay, I accomplished that, I got that done, I got that, but it was just like, it was so, like you said, flat.
Even sitting in the chair while I was doing it was flat. Everything was flat.
It was amazing what he said, and I didn't, 80% I didn't get what he said, because that was the words just didn't make sense to me. There to hear what there, what here, what are you talking about? Then, yeah, but it seemed that Jack really got what he was talking about.
Have you talked with Deborah lately? She's was having a little bit of a hard time, but she seems to be.
I think she's feeling more connected. She felt kind of isolated, but I think she's feeling a little bit better.
Okay.
You know, I mean, it probably is